Hello, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Hope for Healthcare with Dr. Katie Cole. Dr. Katie Cole is a holistic physician, organizational well-being consultant, and change agent, working with industry leaders in proven strategies to heal our national healthcare system and our culture of medicine. Stay tuned to hear today's speaker.
Welcome everyone to Hope for Healthcare. This is a podcast in which we interview expert leaders around the country on best practices for healing our national healthcare system and our culture of medicine. I want to extend a very warm welcome today to my colleague, Dr. Andrew McLean. Dr. McLean is clinical professor and chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences and associate dean for wellness at UND School of Medicine and Health Sciences. He has received the American Psychiatric Association Bruno Lima Award for outstanding contributions to disaster psychiatry, and he has been conferred with numerous teaching excellence awards, as well as distinguished alumnus recognition. Dr. McLean previously was the medical director of the North Dakota Department of Human Services. He has served on numerous clinical, administrative, and regulatory boards, including medical licensing and professional health programs. He has lectured internationally on pertinent behavioral and public health issues. Dr. McLean has an interest in collaborative models of care, as well as individual and community resilience. I am so excited to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much, Dr. McLean, for being with us today.
Thanks, Dr. Cole.
Yeah. Well, you know, in our previous discussion, you know, you've mentioned that you're really passionate about, you know, promoting well-being for your own students, medical residents, and faculty. Can you tell us a little bit more about your passion and what you've been doing with your healthcare system?
Sure. So my background is I grew up in the family of a country doc, and where my mom was a nurse and my dad was a country physician. And so I grew up, you know, going out on house calls with them and scrubbing for surgery and all the things you can't do nowadays. But I also, you know, I had a real appreciation for not only the dedication and commitment to a community, but also that it's not just one person. There's, you know, the whole family was actually part of that. And one of the reasons I decided not to become a country doc was I also saw the toll that it took on my dad, leaving the house at 2 a.m. and missing supper every fourth night and things like that. And so, you know, I grew up with both the appreciation, but the understanding of the cost that it took. Particularly when people are more isolated. And so as I went through my medical school program and residency and began practice, I got involved in, you know, supervising you know, practitioners, and also became involved in our state medical licensing board. I was on that board, also was the chair of our professional health program board, which essentially was the impaired physicians board. And so, you know, in working with colleagues, but also trainees, we know that if we see issues very early on and nip those in the bud and give people support, it helps not only them, but also the burden to society and patients. If we ignore that or watch people kind of smolder along and struggle, they're the ones who end up getting in trouble and then causing problems also with their patients. And so, you know, I recognize that we really have an obligation to step in and assist people, not only for the good of our profession, but also for those individuals and also our patients.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you definitely hit the mark when you said that, you know, you can catch things early on. And I think providing these skills necessary for self-care, advocacy, even some leadership training in the beginning can make a very, very big difference in somebody's career. Mm-hmm. And really help them be successful in their current environment. So,
yeah, and it's not a surprise. Most recently, the Surgeon General Vivek Murthy has talked about, you know, isolation as being a public health crisis. And certainly I've seen that in practice over the years with colleagues, that many times the ones who get into trouble with their practice and personal lives are those who don't have the opportunity to have support among colleagues, bounce things off of their colleagues. We all have questions about practice or different stresses in our professional and personal lives, and having people to bounce that off of makes a huge difference. And so, you know, I think we were seeing this certainly post or pre-pandemic, with more isolation. But the pandemic certainly isolated many of us more. And we've certainly seen numbers continue to climb in terms of people feeling isolated, in terms of younger generations in particular feeling more stressed.
Well, how do you address isolation at UND School of Medicine?
So what we've been doing, we actually have a lot of interprofessional interactions with our trainees. So not only amongst themselves, but also with their colleagues in PT, OT, physician's assistants. And so they learn early on that it takes a village, and within their practice and care for patients, it's typically not just them. Or if they feel it's just them, they know that there are people that they can reach out to and refer patients to and get assistance with. And so that's been a big part of it, is just the interprofessional training. Also, one of the first things that I did, I've been chair of the Department of Psychiatry for about 8 years, and more recently was appointed the Associate Dean for Wellness. One of the first things I did, though, was I hired a medical student advocate, essentially a wellness advocate for students, residents, et cetera, so that they had an identified person that they could touch base with if they were having stresses. We specifically set this up not to be a therapist, but to be someone who they could bounce things off of, and not to over-pathologize, the stress that comes with medical school, but then to also be able to have someone who can screen and refer on to higher levels of care if needed. So we've since then added another individual to help in another part of the state. Our state is very rural, and our medical school is such that we have the first year and a half or so basic sciences training at one campus, and then they go out to one of the other four campuses or even more rural. And so we want to make sure that as they move out into those other clinical areas, that they still have individuals that are identified that they can reach out to, and that can also reach out to them to make sure that they're not struggling or isolated.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm so glad to hear that you are addressing wellness and well-being at the early stages, even in medical school and health science training. I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. And I like that you mentioned that your wellness director is not a therapist. Mm-hmm. can you go a little bit more into detail about and the role that the wellness director plays?
Sure. So what they do, and one of them in particular in the basic science years, so she will have she'll do training on resilience and meditation. She actually is a certified yoga instructor. At times of pre-exam, she will coordinate to have therapy dogs come by and just reduce the stress as they're going into their exams. She's identified as helping people to navigate mental health system if they need to. She will answer the phone any time of day. She will assist the students or others in getting the care that they need. And she is really recognized by the students as someone who is extremely supportive, to the point that she's been recognized with a number of awards, for having done so. I just had a conversation yesterday with one of my colleagues kind of praising that individual about how integral she is within the medical students' experience.
And you mentioned that she also has a role of triaging and being able mm-hmm. to refer. Can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit more about that?
Sure. So we actually have with our medical school, we do the well-being index for medical students, which came out of Mayo initially. And so we actually proactively will screen, and it's anonymously, but we will see, have our fingers on the pulse of how our students are doing. And so we'll watch and see if there are any particular trends. We also have anonymous links for students to reach out if they have concerns. We take really a proactive stance of trying to be preventative and trying to make sure that if we see anyone who is struggling, whether it's a class as a whole or particular individuals, that we then reach out to them and remind them that they have the opportunity to visit with our wellness advocates. And so that's been very successful.
That's great. And then do you also offer, do you have any kind of mental health treatment as well available for your students?
Right. So we have the university has the counseling center, which is campus-wide, and then they also have the ability to actually have the medical students set up appointments virtually. And so, if they're on a rotation out in the western part of the state and they need follow-up, they're able to actually set that up virtually. And so there's really continuity of care. Another thing that we've done, which is, I think, somewhat unique with our professional health program, which initially was set up for, physicians and also physicians' assistants, those who are licensed in the state of North Dakota have what's called a professional health program. And it's similar to other safe harbor type programs. So you can either self-refer, and if you do so, then you don't have to check on your medical licensing application that you have any issues with substance use or mental health issues, et cetera, if you're actually already getting care for that. That most PHPs, though, professional health programs also have mandated referrals for people who have been identified. Clinicians who are identified as having difficulty, and then they're mandated to follow through. We actually have afforded that for our medical students as well. So they can self-refer to the professional health program, even though they're not licensed, but they are afforded the same resources as our physicians are.
Oh, that's wonderful. Is there like sometimes there can be a little bit of stigma though around the PHPs? How do you address
Exactly.
that with your students? How do you address that stigma?
Right. Well, we do education, on those opportunities. The student affairs office has a close relationship with the PHP, and then like I'd mentioned with the wellness advocate, they during orientation, they again reiterate the resources and opportunities that are there for those students. And so, I think that it helps them to understand that this can be a lifelong issue, a lifelong process. And again, nipping problems in the bud early reduces a lot of burden to everyone going forward.
Absolutely. What are some of the other projects that have been your top priority as Dean, Associate Dean of Wellness?
So since having been appointed, and it's been actually less than a year, but we've developed a well-being task force within our medical school, and our medical school is mentioned more than medical students. It's faculty and students from occupational therapy, physical therapy, medical lab sciences, and sports medicine, et cetera. And so all of those groups, we get together. There's representation not only with faculty, but also student membership. And so we're looking at essentially doing an evaluation of where is our current culture of well-being and particular areas. So what we've done is we've categorized it under culture, learning, and also environment and benefits. And so within those areas, what are things that we can do to enhance and make our culture even more one of belonging and healthy. And so we're in the midst of refining that right now. And we have, 6 month plan, 18 month plan, five-year plan. This interestingly dovetails with the university as a whole, which has a strategic plan for leading in particular pillars. And one of those pillars is actually affinity and diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so this actually dovetails nicely. Also, my role, as I've seen it, is not only with our medical school per se, but I've always said that universities have an obligation to the community at large and regionally. And so part of what I also want to do is to look at what other healthcare organizations are doing for wellness for their providers, because 75% of our practitioners in our state are also volunteer faculty. They may not be salaried by the medical school, but they clearly, are teaching our students. They have their own stressors, and many of them belong to a number of different healthcare organizations. So part of what I want to do too is coordinate with those healthcare organizations as to what all are you doing for wellness for your providers. And not to reinvent the wheel, but if there are gaps, how can we assist them in filling those gaps to make all of our providers healthier?
Well, I mean, I think that's great that you developed a wellness task force. I mean, that's one of the things that even the Surgeon General talks about, and the National Academy of Medicine report is encouraging all organizations to have, and it's a good starting point. And mm-hmm. I love that it is dovetailing along with your mission and vision mm-hmm. with the healthcare system or in the state as well. So I think that's really important that you're linking everything together and that you're also evaluating the program. I think that's mm-hmm. the key too. So you can right. actually see your own internal results.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, oftentimes we fail at figuring out first what the issue is, or even asking those who are affected, you know, what they need, what they prefer, and kind of go in blindly and start just charging through. And so I think we're being very intentional about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with our school, as I mentioned, there are many other individuals besides medical students, and we even have research in biomedical sciences. And so when we have campuses elsewhere, one of the things I've been very cognizant of is it's very easy to focus on just one particular campus or one particular population. And we oftentimes forget, you know, who we're ignoring, you know, who we're not bringing into the circle. And so I think representation across the board is really, really important. We also, in our medical school, we have, I think it's the only, it was certainly the first PhD in Indigenous health. And so we have also, we've had a program since I was a medical student of called Indians into Medicine, where a certain number of slots within our medical school are dedicated towards individuals of American Indian or Alaska Native populations. And so we're also very mindful of, you know, different cultures and different populations that may have different needs than we may think going out, you know, shooting out the box. So again, representation has been really important.
And, you know, I'm curious, how have your students and residents found some of that resilience training to be when they actually get on rotations and they're dealing with the stress of healthcare day to day in the culture? How have you had any feedback yet on how they're managing that better than they would have without the training, or any words of wisdom you have for other physician leaders out there who are trying to create a task force?
We do have follow-up, and again, I think one of the advantages of adding another wellness advocate, particularly out in the western part of the state, has been that continuity and continuing to touch base. And so in terms of data, we are actually looking more mindfully at some of the surveys that are being done. When I came on board as wellness, the Associate Dean for Wellness, you know, I became aware that some of the students and faculty have been surveyed, but we weren't necessarily looking at and tracking, you know, the data on that and utilizing it to move things forward. And so we're in the process now of doing a deeper dive into that analysis. You know, certainly anecdotally, it's been seen as positive. There's also something unique with medical schools. At the end of graduation for all medical students in the U.S., there's something called the GQ, which is the graduate questionnaire that comes out, and they ask questions retrospectively on your experience as a medical student. And so some of the questions also have to do with, you know, support within the medical school, and how was that for you, and are there areas that can be improved? And so we recently had a survey this past year. The LCME Liaison Committee on Medical Education came in and did a survey, and so all medical schools that are accredited, they track very carefully what the student response is, particularly within that graduating GQ, and so then we refine, you know, areas that, you know, may be, you know, needed for improvement.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the areas that you've talked about as well that you've been working on is your telehealth mm-hmm. education. Can you go into a little bit of that? Because that's, you know, that's becoming, you know, more popular now, especially for, I think, quality of life for healthcare practitioners too.
Yeah.
and then being able to reach, you know, remote populations of patients. So I'd love to hear more about your program and what you're doing with that.
Yeah, absolutely. As you can imagine, in our rather frontier state, you know, access is difficult. We all know that, you know, recruiting people into mental health has been a challenge. In our state also, we, you know, in addition to the vast distances, we also have blizzards. We also have things that happen that disrupt, you know, one's typical clinical appointment times. And so for many years, when I was with the Department of Human Services, we had developed telemedicine to help to meet that need. And now in our residency program, we do intentional training for our residents in both telehealth, but also in visiting those sites in person. You know, I think it's wonderful. Telehealth brings a lot, I think, to the patient experience, particularly those who, you know, you don't want to take time off to travel a great distance. Or like I said, you may just be disrupted by, you know, weather or something else that occurs. And so we meet a lot of needs by telemedicine, but it's not exactly the same as being in person. And it's interesting, during COVID, you know, I think a lot of healthcare organizations were challenged as to how to shift to, you know, telemedicine. We were doing that previously for a long time. And so both for psychiatry, I think it's an easier shift, but also for, you know, our area, it was easier as well. So for our residency training program, what we do is we have 6 residents per year. And in the 3rd and 4th years, we have them do telemedicine a half a day per week to particular sites out in different parts of the state. And then one day a month, we ask them to go out to those sites. And so they're able to see the clinic, see the staff, see the patients, you know, get a feel and be part of the community, as opposed to being a doc in the box who really doesn't understand the culture, the setting, the resources that are there. And so I think we do a really nice job of training our residents well into how to utilize telemedicine. And so it's been very well received, and we've gotten certainly good feedback on that. And I would say about half of the residents that we graduate go on to practice in our state or in our region. And so they're well aware of the issues, the culture, the resources, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's great that you're training your students and residents in telehealth and telemedicine. And, you know, there is an art to it. And especially because I'm a psychiatrist and I've practiced telehealth on and on for 15 years. Mm-hmm. And I do think that when you are able to go in person, even one day a month, or, you know, even if you're out of town or something, mm-hmm. you're meeting, but it does make a difference to be part of that community. And I think there are ways to really help patients feel like they're being cared for and to have that, you know, to build a rapport effectively. It just takes a little bit more effort in a different way when you're on telehealth. Yeah. But I think that's wonderful that you're doing that. And I know a lot of doctors are switching over to a hybrid practice too, where they're doing some telehealth, and it's making a difference in quality of life too.
Yep.
And they're getting, you know, it's less administrative burden too when you're doing telehealth. So I think that might be one of the solutions for burnout in healthcare.
Right. And, you know, I think in terms of, you know, protective factors against burnout is, you know, having some control over your schedule and your daily practice. And I think telehealth certainly affords that. Another opportunity that's come about because of how we're doing our training is it gives those communities the opportunity to meet prospective, you know, recruits. And so we've had a number of our residents who have chosen to stay in those parts of the state because of their experience in going out there. And so that's been certainly a plus.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. McLean, are there any other aspects to what you're doing as Dean of Wellness that you want to discuss today with our audience?
Yeah, I think one of the areas that I think is important that we've worked on in terms of you know, physician wellness or provider wellness is reducing the barriers in people getting help. You know, we are what we would call, you know, safety sensitive, you know, practitioners, not unlike airline pilots or others that are in, you know, specialized areas where it's really important that the public knows that we have safe individuals providing that sort of service. At the same time, you know, I think for many years, we disincentivized providers in getting help because they had to check a box that said they had some issue, or, you know, they had to report. And so I, some of the work that we've done when I was with our state licensing or with the professional health programs, or even when I did work for the Joint Commission, is when we would visit with healthcare organizations and looking at their privileging documents, you know, do you ask unnecessary questions that really have nothing to do with safety of patients that would cause people to not want to check that box? I certainly have had colleagues who had refused to go in and get help because they didn't want to have to check somewhere that they were actually receiving treatment. And so, you know, I think we've been moving in the right direction, both with healthcare organizations looking at those documents for privileging credentialing, as well as state licensing boards, you know, looking at their licensing application materials to see, you know, what is it that's really required to maintain safety for patients and get rid of questions that are really stigmatizing and don't really have much to do with patient safety. In addition, as I mentioned, those safe harbor opportunities, if there are professional health programs where people, providers can get engaged with assistance and don't then have to check the box that, you know, they have some issue with mental health or substance use, that's definitely a plus as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm really grateful that you're working on that. I know a lot of states are working on changing over the credentialing process, and mm-hmm. the Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation, of course, has a toolkit on their website, and Corey Feist is, the CEO is always happy to mentor others in trying to adopt that for the state and medical board credentialing. So
absolutely,
that's wonderful to hear. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, are there any last words of wisdom that you want to leave with our audience today before we wrap up?
You know, I first of all, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to just visit with you, Dr. Cole. I think the medical profession, the healthcare professions, you know, we have an obligation to provide excellent and safe service, but we also have an obligation to take care of ourselves, which then helps everyone. And so I think we just continue to move forward in ways that reduce barriers for providers getting the help that they need, recognizing it's an occupational hazard. It's stressful. And then also, you know, training our students, our early career practitioners, in making sure that they're aware, self-aware of what their needs are, and that we've reduced barriers for them to be able to reach out for help, and that we stay connected and help them to not be isolated. I think that's the key for a healthy community.
I couldn't agree more. And we definitely need each other, and we need a standard for what we consider to be professional working environments, mm-hmm. and nurturing and thriving working environments. Mm-hmm. So the more that we come together and we have training in that, I think that really does make a difference, because then we can shift our culture.
Yeah. And I think the last thing I'll mention, Dr. Cole, is that, you know, I've been through numerous generations. My father was a doctor. I'm a doc. My son's a doc. But, you know, the Gen Z and the millennial generations and others, they're kind of teaching us that we need to focus more on that. And I think that they're not, you know, willing to jump through some of the hoops that we all felt that we were supposed to and needed to jump through. And I think that they're helping to change the landscape as well in terms of self-care.
Absolutely. And as much as we gripe about the millennials, I think that it's, we all do it, but I think it's also important they're bringing a different aspect and perspective to the working environment. And I think if we can be open-minded and embrace some of those really good ideas and mold that into our standard of, you know, professional work ethic and culture, I think it really does make a difference, and it's more inclusive. So.
Absolutely.
And there are future generations, so why not build a healthier foundation of healthcare that takes into account our future?
I tell people, you know, as I get closer to retirement, that I'm actually very content and gratified knowing that we've trained our next generation well. And I also joke with people, my primary care doc is young enough to be my daughter. And it just doesn't seem right, but that's the way it is. And so, we need to hand over a healthy culture to the next generation.
I couldn't agree more. Well, thank you for your part, Dr. McLean, in helping us change our culture. in America. And thank you for your wisdom and your dedication and your commitment and for your time today to being on the podcast.
Thanks for the visit.
All right. And everyone, if you have any questions about what we've discussed today, of course, I'll have Dr. McLean's information on the website, and we'll be posting all the links as well and articles that he's written. So if you have any questions, you can feel free to reach out to him, and I'll also post his contact information. All right. Thanks for tuning in today, everyone. Take care.